This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear an update on the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico.
If you think offshore drilling can be safe, you're wrong. If you think it's doing us any good, you're wrong. If you think we should be doing any more of it, you're wrong.
We'll hear an update on a recent internal memo from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement that was leaked to the press.
This memo was about stopping opposition to the new practice of police immigration collaboration to supposedly get undocumented workers.
We'll talk about another case in which the FBI targeted Black Panthers for a crime they did not commit.
Sadly, these two men have spent 40 years in jail for a crime they didn't commit.
Stay with us. Michael Ratner, the center has some cases involving Germany. Can you explain?
Well, only peripherally Germany. I actually just came back from Berlin, where we had a meeting, the center lawyers, myself and a lawyer from the center named Katie Gallagher, with Wolfgang Kolick, who's the German lawyer we work with, and with an amazing lawyer named Gonzalo Boye, who is a Spanish lawyer and is the main lawyer in two cases that the center is involved in Spain. And those cases are involved with the U.S. torture program. One case is before the famous Judge Garzon, and that we want to talk about a little bit as they try and get rid of Garzon. And the other case is before Judge Velasco, who's good also, but not a Garzon.
Garzon was a Pinochet judge, right?
Yes, Garzon is the Pinochet judge, and he's a big believer in international justice, universal jurisdiction, and that crimes committed anywhere in the world, major crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity and torture, can be prosecuted anywhere in the world, Spanish courts or anywhere else. So he went after the Bush administration for the torture program. And the two cases have slight differences, but they're related. One, the Garzon case is investigating the entire torture program of the United States, Guantanamo and others. The other case before Judge Velasco is investigating what we call the Bush Six, which are the six lawyers who wrote the torture memos. What's fascinating about these cases is they're going to stay in Spain because there's four people in those cases who are Spanish nationals or have other connections to Spain, and therefore Spain has a real, what you would call a jurisdictional hook to hold on to those cases. These aren't going away. So what the center did, and I really, we intervened in one case, which is the Garzon case, as the center. And in the other case, we filed an expert affidavit saying that whatever the U.S. has done, it hasn't done anything really to investigate this and the courts ought to go forward. And Gonzalo Boye is a fabulous attorney. I mean, very aggressive, very strong, involved in both cases. And so we're moving on those. I mean, they've actually taken testimony in the Garzon case. Two of the people, the Spanish national and the Spanish citizen, have testified about what happened to them in Guantanamo. And they mentioned when they asked, well, who did this to you? They just said, well, we saw this guy named Miller walking around, and we heard that he was some guy named Miller. And, of course, that's General Jeffrey Miller, who was involved in the torture program at Guantanamo.
What kind of media attention is this getting?
Well, in Spain, this is huge, but it's not necessarily huge because it's going after the United States. Garzon, in addition to opening the investigation of the United States, a year or two ago opened an investigation of the disappeared from the Spanish Civil War from 1936 to 1939. There's 130,000 or something. Well, at that point, when he did that, the right wing, and I mean really right wing, something called Clean Hands or something, Mano Limpia, and the Falange, which is the right wing, filed a criminal case against Garzon saying you've gone beyond your judicial competence because there was an amnesty given for the crimes that happened during the Civil War and under Franco. And by going against it, you're going outside your jurisdiction as a judge and you can be criminally prosecuted. Garzon said and responded, well, that's ridiculous because amnesties can't amnesty war crimes and disappearance is a continuing crime until you solve it. But he lost on everything and they even indicted him. So he was indicted. Now, what's most interesting, he was indicted for that. And then when I was in Germany a few days ago, the judge who actually did the indictment was forced to resign. And the reason, Judge Varela, the reason he was forced to resign is that judge actually, who's a right winger, went to the plaintiffs and helped them draft the complaint against Garzon. And then after drafting the complaint, he decided that it was a good enough complaint to go forward against Garzon. So the whole thing has been totally corrupted. My guess is that what's happening with Garzon is they're going after him really because he's opening the Spanish Civil War. That's pretty clear. And what happened, I think he'll survive, but it's not going to be necessarily the easiest thing in the world. They're really after him, and it's not because of going after the Bush Six. It's because of what's happening in Spain. And, you know, after Franco, there was this so-called transition period where they gave the amnesty, which is still continuing today. So what you're really seeing is the fight over moving it to a democracy or continuing with all of these people, who some of whom are still there from the Franco period as judges.
Yeah, and you have Spain on the verge of going under, just like Greece. So there's going to be real economic turmoil in that country as well as political turmoil. And we know what happened the last time there was economic turmoil in the 30s.
What's changed the tide a little bit on Garzon is partly getting rid of this judge and all of that. But there was a demonstration in Madrid of 60,000 people protesting what was happening to Garzon and saying, we want the amnesty nullified and we want the graves open, essentially. 60,000 people. Almodóvar was on the stage, and so was, I got a note from my friend Reed Brody. He was one of the speakers at the demonstration. He was very, very pleased.
Excellent. Could the right wing, Michael, bring out 60,000 people to a demonstration in Spain?
I don't think they could, actually. No. This actually made people pay attention. There were demonstrations in 20 cities across Spain. So I think Garzón's going to hold on because he's a courageous judge. And secondly, because he's the one who's going after the torture conspiracy in the United States. You look at the contradiction. Garzón believes that nothing can be amnestied and that war crimes should be prosecuted. And at the same time, the contradiction is Spain allows that, but at the same time, they have an amnesty that supposedly amnesties their own war crimes. So you have Garzón looking at other people's war crimes, but when he starts to look at Spain's, they say go.
And here in the United States, the Obama administration says we will not go after him, that we have to look forward, not backward.
That's so why we're looking to Spain.
An amnesty.
We're going to give you updates on this case because this is an important case. The Senate's putting a lot of effort into it. It was very hard to intervene, actually. I was at the Spanish consulate a number of times trying to get all these apostilles. I don't know if you know what those are. Those are like special seals they put on papers that go to Europe. It's called an apostille.
So anyway. Highly formalized process
yes.
there.
Well, everywhere, really, to get this from various consulates. But I think we'll be in. We're waiting for the ruling.
Update to follow. Michael, when I was out in California, I heard that a car was parked in Times Square. The flasher lights were on. The engine was left idling. No one in the car. It was checked out, and there were firecrackers and fertilizer that wouldn't explode and some kind of primitive detonation device. I came back to New York. What's going on?
Well, you know, we all were reading the newspapers about this vehicle in Times Square that, had it exploded, would have probably injured a great number of people. They got the guy they said did it, who apparently has confessed, et cetera, and they seem to have a lot of evidence because he not only apparently screwed up making the bombs, he seems to have done a pretty bad job, a good job if you want to say from a safety point of view, but certainly a bad job from wanting to explode it. But then he left evidence everywhere, according to what you read, the keys to his house in the car, the cell phone records. I mean, the whole thing was VIN numbers on the car because it didn't explode, the whole thing. So they got this guy. But there's a few lessons in it that are pretty interesting. I mean, they didn't stop an explosion. They were just lucky. All the surveillance they do in this country and all the profiling and all the wiretapping, you know, they never found this guy. He was able to actually park a car in Times Square loaded with bombs. The Fortress America isn't working so good. But then the next parts are really amazing. You read in the paper that he is taken off a plane on his way to Dubai. Well, how did he get on an airplane on his way to Dubai 48 hours really after they found this, when they knew who he was? They put him on a no-fly list. So the first thing you have to say to yourself is, what the heck is a no-fly list doing here? Here they stop all our friends from, you know, T-shirts or a similar name or this or that, and they let a guy through who they think is the guy who put this bomb in the car. And it's almost hard to believe. What's the purpose of all the security used at the airport if this guy got on a plane from Dubai? And they only got him because the lists of the passengers then are sent back, this is what the paper said, back to transportation security or somewhere, and they check those lists themselves. But by that time, the plane was already shut the door. It was on the runway ready to take off. This guy almost got to Dubai in 2 seconds despite a no-fly list designation. And also, the FBI had actually had him under their surveillance and were tracking him after the bombing, the attempted bombing. Afterwards, they found the guy and they were tracking him, but they didn't arrest him. They were just tracking him, and they lost him. So they not only they lost him, and then he got on the plane, and he was able to do this. So what does that tell you except that we're not going to end this sort of stuff unless we start getting at the causes?
Well, yeah, which is something they don't want to discuss. But it's the same kind of incompetence that led to 9/11. Where they were told a plane will hit a big building. They knew who these people were. The plane hit the big building, and then they didn't do anything to stop even the second plane. This is so useful. They're putting a whole number of cameras where my office is on Ground Zero. They're putting more cameras in Times Square. They already got 87. I mean, they're going to beef up the police surveillance state like crazy on the backs of this.
The problem is, and we've said this over and over, the over-collection of data, be it written or visual, so the more information they gather, I think the more complicated and ineffective their systems are going to be. They have new intelligence centers all over the country. They don't talk to each other. They don't share information, and their computers don't know how to weed it out.
Yeah, they just spy on us. And in the meantime, the central discussion about what kind of beef would a Pakistani have with the United States is never held. They're flying drone airplanes and bombing people in Pakistan. I haven't seen that once in the news.
No. I talked to a woman journalist today from Pakistan who's talking about drones flying over Pakistan. There's, you know, people being killed all the time. And until we actually get at the bottom of what this country is doing, you know, you're going to find whether it's big groups like, you know, Al-Qaeda, et cetera, or whether it's going to be individuals who are angry, you're going to find this. And what could the cameras really do? The camera would have recorded the bomb exploding. Congratulations.
I mean,
the guy pulls up the car, boom.
And in the meantime, the guy doesn't appear to be a religious fanatic. He had a bachelor's degree, he had a master's degree. Most of these suicide bombers are not religious fanatics. So they're out looking for the Taliban, these religious fanatic groups.
Well, the Pakistani woman today said to me one thing that's worrisome about, from a point of view if you're Muslim or Pakistani, is because this guy really fits a, quote, normal Pakistani living in the United States. And therefore, you're going to be, if you're a Pakistani, you're going to be under suspicion everywhere in the United States by everyone. You're going to be discriminated against, et cetera.
Exactly. There will definitely be a backlash in terms of animosity towards certain communities. And that's the kind of thing that we don't want to see.
You know, they said he confessed before he was given Miranda warnings. Miranda warnings are the warnings where you have a right to see a lawyer, anything you say can be used against you, et cetera. But he gave a confession, and they didn't give him Miranda warnings, they first interrogated him. And then I sort of looked it up, and I said, what is that? And it's called public safety exception to Miranda.
Oh,
now,
no kidding.
Never knew there was a public safety exception to Miranda.
I didn't either.
But it's a case called Quarles v. New York from 1989.
Oh, Quarles, yeah.
And I don't really know this, but apparently if there's a imminent, you know, chance of like mass destruction or even a kidnapping, presumably in death, you don't have to give Miranda warnings. You can actually question a person for a certain amount of time, a reasonable, whatever that means, without giving Miranda warnings under what's called the public safety exception to Miranda.
You know what the Carmen Miranda rights are?
That's the banana rights.
Those are the rights to put fruit on your head and dance wildly.
We don't know what would have happened with Bush because they got this guy, if it's the right guy, they got him with the confession and everything. Bush administration had tried to test this idea that you could hold an American citizen in preventive detention or really an enemy combatant. They did that under both the Padilla case and the Al-Mari case. And I think for a while the Obama administration continued the Al-Mari case. But this guy, they could have, arguably, if they find some connection to Taliban or Afghanistan or something, or they could have conceivably argued that he could be held in preventive detention. But I think they've already issued an indictment, essentially a terrorism indictment.
Michael, it's been a couple of years since the latest RNC, and Amy Goodman was arrested there. What is the center's interest in this?
Well, Heidi, last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights filed a federal civil rights complaint in the United States District Court in Minnesota on behalf of Democracy Now! Journalist Amy Goodman, Nicole Salazar, and Sharif Abdel-Qaddous. challenging their arrests at the Republican National Convention in 2008. They were arrested trying to cover a march by protesters. The cops claimed that journalists who wanted to cover protests should either embed themselves with the police or use telephoto lenses. So pretty obvious what happened here. I think we're going to prevail. The suit asks for damages and injunctive relief against law enforcement on First Amendment grounds, particularly the rights of journalists. It's an important issue, or really, as we go into a period where dissent will be increasing and we want it covered by independent journalists like those at Democracy Now!
Well, they've got video of one of the journalists being pummeled and taken down by the police. Amy tries to go to her defense. They arrest Amy.
So, Heidi, now, I know you didn't witness Amy and company actually getting arrested, but you were in Minneapolis at the time, and you had some role here. What was it?
I was there actually with Jeff Brady, our producer, and we were with Bruce Nestor, president of the National Lawyers Guild from a few years ago. We were waiting outside the facility where they were holding Amy and the others till at least, I think, 10 at night when they got out. There was a whole group sort of camped out on the lawn. A lot of other people had been arrested as well. That was the one of the first major nights there. So it was an experience. We never had seen anything quite like it in terms of the number of streets that were literally off limits to everyone. Luckily, Jeff and I had Pacifica press passes, so we could get a little closer. As Amy's case brings up, there was a limit to how close anyone could get.
It's fascinating to me that according to these cops, the only way you can cover up protests is with a telephoto lens, or you have to embed with the cops.
Yeah, it was very frustrating because there would be activities going on that you wanted to get near, and you would be told to go as the police always do. They tell you to go this way, that way, you walk a mile that way, and they say, no, you have to go this way, but they're all cordoned off ultimately.
Well, you know, one of the lessons that they learned from Vietnam was you can't have reporters out there reporting objectively. In Iraq, they embedded the reporters with the army, and now that's coming home. They're embedding the reporters with the police department in Minneapolis.
There are reports that nearly 200,000 gallons of crude oil is spilling into the Gulf of Mexico each day as engineers work to cap the wellhead. Meanwhile, oil dispersants are deployed on the water surface to break up the oil slick before it reaches sensitive estuaries and the shoreline. We talk with Jackie Savitt, Senior Campaign Director for Oceana's Pollution Campaigns, to get an update on the environmental impacts this oil spill is having on wildlife and on the shoreline. Jackie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, can you give us, in a sort of nutshell, your take on the magnitude of what's happened and what the repercussions will be?
Sure. You know, I think what we're looking at is it's almost like an underwater volcano gushing oil at about 200,000 gallons per day, and possibly even 10 times more than that. It's been gushing now for almost 2 weeks. The actual place where the oil is coming from is a mile below the surface of the water. It's a mile deep water, and the pipe it's drilling into the earth goes down another 3 miles to a reservoir, which we don't really know exactly how much oil is in there. The company's predictions for how they're going to stop it, none of them sound very promising. The soonest that they're likely to be able to stop it is at least another week or two. It's already been 2 weeks, and it's possible that their second idea for how to stop it could take as much as a few months, and that's also not guaranteed to work. So we really don't know the full magnitude of the problem. But we do know that the Gulf of Mexico is an extremely rich area biologically. It's where a lot of our fish come from. A lot of our shellfish come from there. Many of the species that make their homes in the Gulf of Mexico are endangered or threatened species, like sea turtles, the North Atlantic right whale, and others. And many of them are extremely important commercially, like the bluefin tuna, also snapper and grouper, oysters, shrimp, crabs, all come from the Gulf of Mexico. And so these animals have been exposed, in some cases have already been exposed to the oil, and oil is very toxic to marine life. It's as soon as it hits the water, not just when it gets to the coast. In many cases, these animals are using the Gulf as a nursery where, for example, bluefin tuna are currently spawning in this area. This is a species whose population is severely overfished, needs to have a successful spawn And when it goes to spawn, it finds itself spawning in a big lake of toxic, nasty oil and chemicals. Birds are nesting now. Sea turtles are getting ready to build their nests on the beaches. Other fish are spawning. And obviously, it's the young, the juveniles, the larvae, that are the most sensitive to the toxicity of these chemicals. It's not a good scene. I think we may never fully know the environmental impacts of the spill. We may never fully know the impacts on populations of these animals. We may see some indication of the impacts by what washes up on the beaches, but this is going to be a long-term problem.
We heard that British Petroleum could, in fact, have prevented this from happening had they installed a certain apparatus that I can't remember the cost, but it was relatively low compared to what the financial and ecological costs are going to be of that. Is this true?
It is and it isn't. It's true that there is such a mechanism that could have been installed for, I'm told, about $500,000. And it's true from what I've read that the company and other oil companies have fought and lobbied against having this mechanism required and probably other safety mechanisms required. However, the reality is equipment fails. Stuff happens. There's human error. So there's no guarantee, no matter how good the technology is or how good the safety measures are, that some kind of accident won't happen.
But after Exxon Valdez, why isn't there a containment procedure readily in place for this kind of disaster?
I think the question is, why do they let companies like BP drill for oil in such dangerous circumstances that can pose these types of impacts without making sure they have a plan and guaranteeing that they can clean up a mistake if they make it? They don't require a bond. They don't require even the company to have insurance, according to what I've read. And yet we just open up our coast to these companies.
And there's limits on liability, so I couldn't believe it. That's like a $75 million limit or something?
There's a $75 million limit on liability. Yeah.
Which this is probably billions. But let me go back to what you're saying about the bond and the safety and all of those issues. Because what you said earlier, and I'm just want to see what you're thinking is there really any way to ever do this safely? I mean, to really drill in a 5,000 feet below, even with all the, let's say they had not lobbied against more safety valves and they'd had a containment procedure. I mean, in the end, aren't we really facing this as a real problem? I mean, that this can't really be done ultimately. Isn't this what this is showing?
Yeah, we don't think this can be done safely, period. And that's why Oceana has opposed expanding offshore drilling all along. We didn't have a lot of friends a year ago when everybody was saying drill, baby, drill, and if you said ban offshore drilling in the halls of Congress, they looked at you like you believed in Santa Claus. But we don't think it can be done safely, and we don't think there's really any reason to take the risk. And that's, to me, I think that's the interesting point about this spill. I think the oil companies convinced the public that drilling was a good idea by putting out three myths. One is that it's going to lower the price of gas at the pump. One of the myths is that it's going to lower the price of gas at the pump. The second is that it's going to make us energy independent. Both of those myths have been debunked by federal studies by the Energy Information Agency that show that even in 20 years when these offshore wells in these new areas are producing, it will only lower price of gas by a few cents. And we all know that that happens every day, up and down a few cents. And that it will not make us energy independent even by 2030. If we drill everywhere in the U.S. that we can drill, we'll still need 60% of our oil and gas to be imported. But the third myth that I think a lot of people were still hanging on to up until a couple weeks ago is that drilling was safe. But now that we've seen that debunked before our own eyes, there's really no benefit to you and me for offshore drilling, for expanding drilling to the East Coast, for example, off the coast of Virginia or even farther north. There's a benefit to the oil companies, obviously, because they can turn a profit from it, but we don't get a profit. And we bear the risks. We're the society that has impacts on the fisheries economies, like we're seeing in the Gulf now, coastal tourism economies, and even just the way of life. And, you know, those people that enjoy their shrimp and their oysters and their gumbo can't do that now. So it really raises a question for me of why would we want to let these companies gamble with our lifestyle for no actual return.
Well, let me ask you about that because, you know, a few weeks ago, I think I was at least surprised that Obama said he was going to open up the East Coast to more offshore drilling. And people, I think, you know, were surprised by that. And, of course, in light of what happened in the Gulf recently, he said, well, we're going to go back and look at this again, or some words to that effect. But he didn't say, we're going to stop it. Right. I mean, do you think there's a chance that maybe they'll stop it? Or do you have any sense of what's going on politically around it right now?
Yeah, I think that we're looking at a potential reset moment, if you will, a potential time when, like after the Exxon Valdez, we passed the Oil Pollution Act, which required double-hull tankers. After this disaster, we should be able to, I think we should be able to at least try to get a ban on expanding offshore drilling. Of course, we're going to have to continue to drill in the Western Gulf and the Central Gulf, where the drilling's already happening. Nobody thinks that's going to end. But whether we want to expand into these new areas, that they really don't have that much oil and gas in the grand scheme of things anyway, I really think when we look at this disaster, we can see sort of the error of that way of going.
How would you describe the power of the oil companies, the profits they make, the lobbyists they have? They had, like, I guess they had their own person in power. They could legislate when Bush and Cheney were there. British Petroleum makes, what, like $6 billion a quarter. How do you get cheap, independent, safe energy, you know, without drilling, and how do you oppose them?
Well, there are two different questions. The first one, how do you oppose the oil industry? It's a very good one. I mean, we've been fighting a David and Goliath battle, not just Oceana, but the environmental community as a whole. It's hard, but I think the bottom line is politicians respond to public sentiment. They were able to get the public ginned up in 2008 with their drill, baby, drill mantra. We need to get the public ginned up now that they're seeing the impacts with some sort of a ban new drilling mantra. So I think that's what we're going to have to do. And I'm not a lawyer. I know you guys are in the legal field and can probably speak better to this than I, but I think that latest Supreme Court decision that's going to allow more corporate money in elections is only going to make that job a lot harder. Is the next president going to be a representative of Exxon Mobil? You know, who knows?
Well, Obama hasn't been terrific on these issues. I mean, as we just said, offshore drilling he went for. He believes there's such a thing as clean coal, and he's into nuclear energy. So it's not exactly like he's an environmental president.
Obviously, I was very disappointed by all of the above, and including especially the drilling one. You asked, Mike, about can we really do without oil or something like to that effect.
Yes.
Obviously, we recognize that we're not going to stop drilling for oil overnight, that we're going to continue drilling where we already are. But the question is, should we be expanding offshore drilling to other areas that aren't currently industrialized, aren't currently at risk? There are deep ocean rigs like the Deepwater Horizon that can produce more oil in a day than all the East Coast, all the West Coast of the United States, and the West Coast of Florida will produce combined in a day. It's really not a whole lot of oil. But on the other hand, if you look at how much alternative energy, clean energy we could produce, if you built offshore wind off the East Coast where there's a lot of our population, so the electricity would be available to the population, we could actually provide more energy by investing the same amount of time and energy in offshore wind. We could provide more energy less expensively and create about 3 times more jobs. And it's never going to spill. So when you compare that to the benefits that we supposedly get from offshore oil, which I can't think of any offhand, it's really hard to imagine why the president would go forward and say, we're going to try to drill in these areas, when really he should be saying, we're going to figure out how to put up wind turbines.
Can you talk to us about the benefits of using dispersal agents versus letting the oil slick come on shore?
Sure. You know, one thing that I think has been a little bit confusing about this whole situation is people are talking about whatever you do, don't let the oil get to the coast. Because in the coast, we have more wading birds and shorebirds, and they're nesting, and there's turtle beaches and oysters and people, and especially if it gets to the coast, there are going to be some nasty photos. Boy, that sure is going to help the environmentalists stop expansion of drilling. So there's been a real interest in not letting it get to the coast, but it's important to realize that, as I said, the spill actually causes toxic effects on marine life as soon as it happens, which is 2 weeks ago. So there's animals living in the ocean, like sea turtles and fish larvae and all kinds of different marine plankton, for example. It's not just about the coast. The dispersion is, unfortunately, sort of a lesser of evils approach. It's not a perfect solution. These are toxic chemicals that I would venture a guess that it'd probably be illegal to dump dispersants in the ocean under any other circumstances. What they do is they divide up, they help the oil dissolve in water. They break up the oil so it can dissolve into the water. It doesn't stay on the surface, and it doesn't float into the coast and coast to shores. Now, because they're some number of miles out, especially where the gushing is happening, is about 50 miles out, the theory is if we can get it to stay in the water and not float with the winds to the coast, it's actually a better option, and it may well be. But what the dispersant does is it makes the oil more available to marine life, as we say in toxicology. The marine life can be exposed to the oil more readily. The oil can have more harmful effects than it might otherwise to the animals in the ocean. So the dispersal is actually a decision of which is worse, having oil washing up on beaches or having it linger in the water with a fish.
And how much is that a political decision by the oil companies in terms of if we see it come onto the beach, it might be more upsetting?
I do think that's part of it. I'm willing to give the federal agencies some credit that in the grand scheme of things that actually getting it out of off the surface is probably a good thing. But it's, you know, if you could really do the calculus, I'm not really sure which one would come up ahead, but it wouldn't be by much.
And what is Oceana doing nationally that we should know about?
What we're doing nationally is we're basically trying to generate support for a ban on any new drilling, including exploratory drilling, because this was an exploratory well. So exploratory drilling is also dangerous, and also including drilling that's planned for the Arctic. This oil spill is not even a worst-case scenario because it didn't happen in a place where you have icebergs and long-term periods of darkness, you know, longer than we have in the Gulf, and cold water. So we definitely are looking at ginning up support for a ban on new drilling, including exploratory drilling and including the Arctic. That's basically our main thing right now. And anyone wants to get in touch with us, they can go to our webpage, which is www.oceana.org. We just started a new petition to try to ban new drilling, which is at stopthedrill.org, so they could check that out also.
It is terrific, and I would suggest that we need a new mantra instead of drill, baby, drill. We need stop the drilling now.
Yes. Seems like the oil industry's motto is spill, baby, spill.
Right, sure.
And then they went to burn, baby, burn.
Right.
Jackie, it's really been a pleasure to have you on, and thank you for the important work that you're all doing.
Well, same to you, anytime.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
Center for Constitutional Rights staff attorney Sunita Patel joins us today to give an update on the recent internal memo from the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, that was leaked to the press. The memo was a response to a civil rights group uncovering the truth on ICE and police collaboration, and it was specifically aimed at their campaign of week-long rallies in 14 cities. The Week of Advocacy was launched in conjunction with an FOIA lawsuit filed in New York by the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the Immigration Justice Clinic of Cardoza School of Law. The suit demands records relating to the, quote, Secure Communities Program. Sunita, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on the show. Always good to be on.
Sunita, there was this secret ICE memorandum that's been uncovered. What's the secret?
Ah, good question. There was a national campaign around uncovering the truth behind police and ICE collaborations that was launched last week in conjunction with the filing of a Freedom of Information Act request federal lawsuit in the Southern District of New York. That lawsuit was filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Day Laborers Organizers Network, and the Benjamin Cardozo Immigrant Justice Clinic. It turns out that the ICE authorities, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Department of Homeland Security, was a little frightened by our launch of this campaign and this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, and decided to launch a media offensive against community organizations that were simply trying to provide information to the public and seeking answers to really important questions around police and ICE collaboration. We were able to get this memo that was leaked to the press that laid out the Department of Homeland Security's plans to publish op-eds by the head of ICE, as well as seeking exclusives with several national reporters.
The underlying issue here, apart from what they're doing from a PR point of view, is the collaboration of ICE, immigration essentially, and local cops. What does that mean, really?
What is happening is very similar to what this Arizona legislation that's been in the news a lot lately. There are several federal programs that the Department of Homeland Security does either through memorandum of agreements or through other operations with local law enforcement, where they incentivize police officers to provide information to immigration in order to determine whether someone is in the country lawfully or potentially is removable. And at that point, that prevents someone from being able to get out of jail. It prevents someone from being able to get release on their own recognizance or be able to get bailed out. And they drop what's called a detainer on them. So basically, non-citizens end up staying in jail, even if there's been an unlawful arrest or some other police misconduct.
So what you're seeking is the information about how this practice works. Is that right?
That's right. The community members want to know to what extent this is leading to racial profiling, to what extent the law enforcement officers actually even know what this information is being used for. We want more information in order for police and communities to make reasonable decisions. The FOIA lawsuit itself is seeking information regarding a particular program called Secure Communities, and that program is in operation in jails, and it's a fingerprint system. And so what ICE is saying is that fingerprints are colorblind, but what we know is that law enforcement agents do not act in a colorblind way. So how someone actually ends up to the point where their fingerprints are getting run is what we're concerned about and what we're seeking information around. This program, they are planning on launching in every prison and jail in the country by 2013, and they've already instituted in 168 jurisdictions. And what's alarming to us, the folks involved in the Uncovering the Truth campaign and at the Center for Constitutional Rights, is that since we've requested records on February 3rd, they have doubled the amount of local agreements that they've put in place rather than just responding to our request.
In that memo, aside from the preparation of op-ed pieces and the like, is there any mention of paying journalists to print this kind of opinion piece?
There is not that information, but there was also an effort to get in touch with law enforcement agencies that they believed would themselves go on the record and publicly speak highly and speak favorably of these kinds of collaboration programs. There were a whole series of talking points that were put out for local law enforcement agencies. There was a revision of their website entitled The Real Facts on Secure Communities. And of course, in there, they lay out that there's been no civil rights complaints. They say that they have been meeting with civil rights groups periodically about these programs as if that is a response for lack of transparency or accountability or monitoring over these programs.
Sunita, what do you hope to accomplish here?
We want to get information. We want to get answers. We want to try and stop these collaborations. We want to try to terminate these programs. They make the community less safe and less secure, and they really don't solve any problems and lead to the greater instances of civil rights abuses.
Sunita, we're really interested in following up when you have more information about this. We interviewed someone recently about what's happening in Arizona, and one of the things that we learned is that actually a lot of law enforcement there doesn't like what's happening. And I would expect that with this, you might have some law enforcement people on our side as well, surprisingly, because they don't like to be told what to do in their jurisdictions all the time.
That's right. Ron Hampton, the head of the National Black Police Association, as well as several other national police organizations, have come out against ICE and police collaborations because it brings barriers to being able to get information from the community, and it creates a situation where crime victims don't want to come forward because they're afraid they're going to get deported and they're going to get put in jail.
Exactly. Well, Sunita Patel, we know you're in court right now. We appreciate your stepping out, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks, Sunita.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Sunita.
Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye. Bye.
We talked today with Klaus Waliszewski, a representative of Amnesty International in Germany. Klaus has been working for decades with Amnesty International on the case of two former Black Panthers, Ed Poindexter and Mondo Wilanga, formerly known as David Rice. The case has not received much attention in the United States. Amnesty International has found that the two men were unjustly convicted of murder and have been in prison since the 1970s. The group has called for a retrial or a release of the two men. Klaus joins us to talk more about this case. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Klaus.
Thank you.
We're here to discuss a case that goes back into the 1970s and involves a mixture that we've discussed a lot on Law and Disorder, that of one or two individuals who have been unjustly, perhaps, set up and convicted of a crime that they didn't commit. Can you give us a few details about Ed Poindexter and David Rice?
Mm-hmm. Sure I can, because I've been involved in this case since 78, and Amnesty has followed this case ever since then. And we don't call them political prisoners, really, for the reason that we consider the USA a country where you can have due process of law, appellate courts, and all this. And usually you can have a fair trial. Of course, we know there are many cases where this doesn't happen. Still, there are no political prisoners for Amnesty in the U.S., but there are several cases where Amnesty has severe doubts about the justified verdicts, and this is one of them.
Tell us what happened way back in the 70s and where we are now.
Mondo Wilanga, he changed his name, and Edward Poindexter. They were both Black Panthers in Omaha, Nebraska in the 70s. And in August 1970, the police was called to a vacant house by a 9/11 call. They went there. In the house, there was a suitcase. There was a bomb in there. When one policeman picked up the suitcase, bomb exploded. Policeman was killed. The question was, who did it? And of course, the police department there thought it must have been those Black Panthers.
And why did they think that?
Because there had been a lot of course, action before that. Later it came out, when we got files, that the FBI had been involved, too, in this counterintelligence program that wasn't known at the trial.
Counterintelligence program.
COINTELPRO. And that from kind of 67, 68 onwards, there had been orders by the FBI to disrupt this organization in Omaha, too.
In this case, what's interesting is that an individual named Dwayne Peek was actually arrested for the crime. Mm-hmm. He confessed to placing the bag and implicated six others, but he didn't mention these two individuals until a later statement. And that's something that we've seen also where someone comes back with a statement, it raises the specter of whether this person was coerced by the police.
Right. So this 15-year-old Duane Peake said he was caught, said he placed the bomb, and only after some periods of questioning he finally was willing to name those two. Now, what happened when he went to court the first time, saw those two sitting there, was asked, well, are these the one who were involved in the killing? He said, no.
This is then, even after he had named them.
Yeah. And when he first saw them at court. Then there was a recess at court. After the recess, he had on some dark glasses. And when the defendant of the two said, please take off your glasses, there was, as they say, a visible gasp in the courtroom because he had red eyes. He had been crying. Then he was interviewed by or interrogated by the attorney. And I can read it to you if you want. He said, what happened to make you shake and bring your nervous condition about now? I don't know. You had a conversation between the time you were placed on the witness stand this morning and the present time now. Isn't that correct? Peake, yes. And there were some things that the police officers told you about that would happen to you, like sitting in the electric chair. Isn't that correct? I didn't have a chance. You didn't have a chance, did you? No. You are doing what they want you to do, aren't you? Yes.
And then what happens? He identifies the two people?
Yes. Then he identifies the two people and says that it was them. So this is a very kind of shaky evidence.
Shaky?
Amnesty thinks. There's another point like this.
Let's stay on this one for one second, because first they get this guy, Peake, the 15-year-old,
right,
at the station house or whatever, and he first doesn't mention Poindexter or David Rice at that point.
Right.
After a while, then the police talk to him, and they obviously do what police do in these cases. Mm-hmm. They pretty clearly suggest, well, it's going to go better for you if you can name the other guys, and here's this guy Rice and this guy Poindexter, and then he names them. Then the guy goes into court, and he sees them across the table, and he says, I don't recognize them. Mm-hmm. He goes out, he gets threatened with the electric chair, comes back in, and he recognizes them.
Right.
So you can understand why Amnesty was involved in the case, right?
Sure, yeah. But there's more to it. For example, the 9/11 call that was made to call the police to the site. This call was withheld during the trial. Why was it withheld? It was taken to the FBI bureau in Washington for analysis. In a memo, somebody wrote, this tape should not be shown, presented at the trial. The reason was, later this tape was found, some years later after the trial, and when it was played the first time, everybody who knew Duane Peake said, this is not Duane Peake's voice. It's a voice of a much older man, not of a 15-year-old. In 2007, actually, the support group and Omar and Lincoln found an expert on voice analysis, and he analyzed the voice, and then also the voice of the present Duane Peake. Duane Peake had disappeared for many years. He was found much later. Anyway, and he said the voice of now Duane Peake and Duane Peake, 15 years old, is not the same. But the court in Nebraska in 2009 argued that even assuming that this voice wasn't the same, this wouldn't justify a retrial.
Now, the voice not being the same would mean that Peake did not make the call to go to the house, and that may have had nothing to do with any of this stuff.
Well, he admitted to placing the bomb, but there must be somebody else who made the call. Now, who made that call? We don't know. Statement by the main witness that he made the call is not true.
It was a lie.
Or not true. It's also a lie. So what can you make of the main witness like this? And there's even more to it if you want.
So these guys have been in jail since when?
They were caught, arrested in 1970 in August.
So 40 years they've been in prison.
40 years this year. The verdict
How old
was
are
in
they?
71. Oh, one is 62 now, Mondo, and 67 about, I think.
I understand that since 1993, the Nebraska Parole Board has continued to vote unanimously to commute both of their sentences to time already served.
Mm-hmm.
Why has that not happened?
It happened because the Board of Pardons, which is important, doesn't grant that because they are elected officials. Elected officials in the USA don't like to grant a pardon to so-called police killers, that they say, because that's why I think the governor of Nebraska has never considered a pardon.
I don't understand. What was the police killing in this case?
No, one officer was killed when the bomb exploded.
Oh, okay.
And so they were officially, they are now police killers. Those
so teams. So you're saying the administrative board granted a commutation of the sentence, but the board that has to approve it, which is elected, Won't.
Won't.
Part of the reason, as I understand it, that they voted to commute the sentences to time served is that there were so many irregularities during the trial because Rice and Poindexter got through the Freedom of Information Act, their FBI files. Of course, they only got part of them. Mm-hmm. Amnesty has said there were irregularities.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it's just isn't enough because the Board of Pardons, elected officials, don't want to make the risk of kind of freeing police killers.
Is there a broad-based public movement in support of the freedom of these individuals?
There isn't, unfortunately, because it's just one case out of several. And unfortunately, this case hasn't gotten much media attendance at all.
Klaus Walczewski, who is a representative of Amnesty International in Germany. Mm-hmm. Klaus, have you been out there to the prison to visit Ed Poindexter and Mondo Wilanga?
Yes, I have.
And can you tell us what they're like and
what that visit was like?
Okay, it's about 10 years ago. And in the 90s, I was there when Poindexter was still in Minnesota in a prison for educational reasons. Now he's back in Lincoln. And Mondo was and is still in Lincoln. They're both very educated people. No threat to anybody. I think by their model lifestyle in prison, they shouldn't be there anymore. I also think, why should people be in prison for 40 years if they even had to commit these crimes?
Right.
Then why should they be in prison? Because they're no threat to anybody, really. Model prisoners, as far as I know, they have suffered enough, really, in my opinion. There's even one former governor of Nebraska who says that he doesn't think that they were justly tried and justly sentenced. They should be free. They didn't do anything but say some radical things, maybe. That's the whole thing they did.
It's staggering to us that in the country we live, the punitive aspect of the sentences that people in the United States serve are so extraordinarily long and much different, really, than the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Germany, for example.
Yeah.
You don't hold people in prison for 40 years in Germany.
No, we don't. Just think of the German terrorists. You know, we had this Baader-Meinhof group in the 70s and 80s, and all of them, I think, except for one, have been freed by now, though they really killed people. They really committed terrorist acts. But in Germany, after 15, 20, or 25 years, they were released because they are no threat to anybody anymore in society, and they have served their sentence. And you shouldn't have vengeance forever, but you should have just punishment, and that's it.
How did you get involved in this work of working for Amnesty International, and specifically in trying to spotlight the injustices done to these two Black Panthers?
Well, I was just kind of radicalized in the N60s when I was a student myself. It just happened to be the USA cases in my group that Amnesty London assigned these cases to my group that I got involved with these. It's just a matter of accident, really. It could have been anything else.
What city were you in the 60s?
In Bremen.
Isn't that where Deutschke was? Where was Rudi Deutschke?
No, he was in Berlin, mainly.
Berlin. But where did the university get taken over? I thought it was Bremen, no?
Bremen, too. Yeah, Bremen was a very radical university. But I was living in Göttingen there, another university.
Okay.
But all universities were kind of affected by that process in those days, you know.
Are you an attorney in Germany?
No, I'm a high school teacher, actually.
Ah.
And do you teach this case to your high school at all?
I do, too. I teach this case and other amnesty cases as well to my students, too, yeah, to make them aware of the world of injustice.
And what's their reaction when you teach these?
Oh, they were very interested, usually, and they are willing to sign, usually, not all, but many of them, any petitions I have, appeals I have from Amnesty, that's working quite well. There's more on the case, like there's a dynamite that was supposedly found in Mondo's house, and it's very dubious, too, because Mondo wasn't there when the house was searched. The house was searched without a warrant. There is conflicting evidence about the police officers where they found it exactly. There's no photo of where they found it. Plus, one Black Afro-American officer on the corpse happened to be near there, was surprised that it would kind of block off a whole section of streets just for searching a house. He said something is wrong with this search of a house. Can't be. So he believes, so a colleague of these police officers there, that his colleagues planted the dynamite there. Later in a federal court of the 8th Circuit Court, reprimanded the officers for having made false statements about where they found the dynamite. But all this even also didn't really add up to having a new trial or releasing, getting him back
in prison. You know, it's important that I think you make this point, because
everybody would say, well, first there was this bomb suitcase, then there was this dynamite. But, you know, what you began this interview with was talking about counterintelligence and what I referred to as COINTELPRO, was really a program of the FBI at this point in time to use all means they could to destroy the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Movement. And it included, it basically said, jail them, get rid of them, prevent them from going forward. And so there was a whole series. We had a case in New York. It was called the Panther 21, which was a case that was tried to destroy the Black Panther Party in New York, put these people on trial for 9 months in 1970-71, and there was an acquittal in 45 minutes, even though they destroyed 21 people's lives for a period of time. So it was common during that period, and the planting of evidence was probably routine when it came to Black Panthers.
I've heard about that.
Thank you very much. It's great to see somebody working on this from from Germany, a case that most Americans and most of our listeners probably have not heard of. But if they haven't heard of it, they should get active on it now. Go to the website. Even had they done it, you know, after 20 years in Europe, these guys would be out. Here it's 40 years now. They're still not out. And it appears from everything that this was a setup. They didn't do it, and despite incredible evidence to that effect, they're still sitting in jail after 40 years, essentially their lives having been destroyed.
That's true, yeah.
So thank you, Klaus.
You're welcome.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.